A warm welcome to everyone on the line. It's a great pleasure to have with us now Sean Stannard Stockton, President and Chief Investment Officer of Ensemble Capital Management and Portfolio Manager of the Ensemble Fund. Prior to Ensemble Capital, Sean worked at Scudder Investments, and I'm sure many of you on the line will appreciate the wisdom, insights, and ideas Sean has shared with the MY Global community in the past, both at our online events as well as our events such as Latticework New York. And I wanted to be sure that we have this chance to speak with you, Sean, given the unusual time in the markets that we're all living through. Thank you also for providing some very valuable content, both with your conference call on the coronavirus impact, as well as your blog, Intrinsic Investing, where you've shared your thoughts as well. Perhaps I'll just turn it to you to kind of set the stage in terms of how you are thinking about this for your investment process. And then we'll have a Q&A, and I would encourage everyone on the line to feel free to type your questions into the online interface. So, Sean, I'll turn it to you.
Great. Well, you know, I'm going to start off by uttering the four most dangerous words that investors ever say, which is that this time is different, and we think it is. However, I think, you know, you expand on what that means exactly. Most importantly, this is not a recession, although it may cause a recession. This is not a financial crisis, although it triggered at least the beginnings of concerns around a financial crisis in credit markets that is in the process of being repaired right now. And this is not a kind of social disruption like wars in the past in which infrastructure and things like that are destroyed. So a lot of the models you might think about that around market crises, those three classes, kind of financial crises, economic crises, and then kind of social crises that have occurred over time in the past, none of those models quite apply. But that doesn't mean that you just kind of throw it all out and say, we have no idea what's going to happen. And most importantly, I think it means that you just need to recognize that the behavior of companies and economies in the past and our different sorts of crisis conditions may not be how things play out right now. But none of that means that you should deviate from kind of your core first principles of investing. For us, that is the idea that you should only own companies, shares of companies, that you have deep conviction in their long-term ability. And then newly, you better be sure they can get through this period of time, which is really hard because this period of time is going to look totally different than so many times in the past. And just I'll give you some quick little examples. You know, if this was a recession, you wouldn't see Walmart and Amazon and CVS trying to hire 500,000 people, right? If this was a recession, you wouldn't see food sales up like 70% was the data I just saw recently. There's all these ways in which the behavior of what's going on does not follow kind of normal sorts of activities that have happened in past crises. And so we think that the kind of ramifications of all of those things are very uncertain. Clearly, I think that's kind of self-evident, and the path the virus takes and its impact on the economy, all those things are very uncertain. And so just recognizing, investors should always recognize how uncertain the future is, but it is at a kind of an all-time high level of uncertainty right now. But all that being said, we do believe that the United States will get through this period of time. You know, that's kind of one of those easy things to say, but it's an important thing to remember. We could well have kind of a rolling multi-year recession. That's not what we expect as our base case, but you'd be kind of naive to write that off as not plausible. McKinsey has been publishing scenario analysis on economics, and today we shared on Twitter kind of they have nine scenarios now with this kind of grid of both the viral impact as well as the counter reactions by humans, you know, not just to stop the virus, but to cure the economy. And so there's a lots of different things being kind of fluent in the various scenarios that could play out, and what that could mean for your companies, I think, is really critical. And then just, you know, continuing to watch what's going on, because the level of uncertainty is going to be reduced over time. As you move forward in time, you know, you'll get more clarity. And some of the things that we may see may not be what we expect to see. Not just better or worse, but that things that, you know, the economy might get better faster than we expect, but that you may see industries not behaving the way you typically would when an economy was improving. So big picture, kind of just a step off and step back, and then I'll let you fire away with questions, is, you know, I think it's important to recognize how different this is from past models. You could say, well, the Spanish flu happened 100 years ago, but, you know, the global economy was not this interconnected world with 4 billion people, 4 billion passengers traveling by air, and, you know, 2.1 billion of those, I think, traveling internationally. It just didn't exist 100 years ago. It's a very, very different sort of world. And yet, saying this time is different doesn't mean, you know, stocks are anything but a claim on future cash flows, and recognizing that and the certainty levels around those cash flows continues to be guiding everything we do as investors.
Sean, you and your team are long-term investors. You seek out great businesses. Has anything surprised you in terms of the moat of those businesses that you invest in, or how this crisis has impacted them? Something maybe that you wouldn't have thought going into this?
So anytime we make an investment, one of the kind of processes that we go through in researching a company is stress testing its business model for a potential recession. You know, we expect that when we make an investment in a company, that we will own that company during and through a recession. Not that, you know, we are projecting there would be one at any given time. We just know when we're making an investment, regardless of what our holding period of the stock ends up being, our reason for owning the company is that we believe we will benefit from being long-term shareholders over a time horizon that is very likely to include at least one recession. So, you know, we went into this believing that our entire portfolio would be able to get through a recession, right? The long-term returns to equity investors don't count if you don't get to the long term. And so, you know, investing in companies that we have very high level of confidence can get through even bad recessions is part of our just standard process. But speaking to the idea that this time is different, you know, if you look at something like Starbucks that we own, if I believe that same store sales were down 3% in their fiscal 2008 and 6% in fiscal 2009, those were, you know, considered really pretty bad results. It was a bad recession, but the stores remained open. Right? You and I could go to them. This is an entirely different sort of scenario right now. Even during the worst recessions, you don't have leading players that are cash flow positive just shuttering all of their stores. And so we were forced, you know, about 3 weeks ago to recognize, hey, we got to stress test these businesses, not for a bad recession. We need to stress test them for, you know, shutdowns, global shutdowns, rolling shutdowns, shutdowns that last longer than we might think that they are most likely to. And so the process that we use is we went through our portfolio and we basically said, okay, how bad could things get such that earnings go to zero, right? Or cash flow, I should say, goes to zero. Now, most all of our companies could handle a year or more of negative cash flow because they have strong balance sheets, but that wasn't, you know, that for us, that was kind of a backup. So we're looking at our portfolio and saying, what are the financial results that would need to occur such that these businesses are cash flow neutral in over the next year. And then we basically, you know, put those kind of assumption in, looking at basically margins and you know, revenue and getting to that number. And then we kind of stepped back and said, okay, can we underwrite that set of assumptions? What we meant by that was, you know, can we as investors, we don't know what's going to happen, but if it gets worse than whatever we've just modeled, then we may have a going concern issue on our hands. And we went through our portfolio and ran those and then looked at, you know, how bad it would have to get and decide, can we believe that it's not going to get any worse than that, or it's extremely unlikely to. We recognize we can't know that every company is going to get through you know, this scenario, but we can believe with very strong conviction that they will. And so almost every single one of our companies passed that test. One company that I'm not at liberty to name exactly at this time because we're not yet at quarter end. We exited one position that was part of a global supply chain in which we said, you know, if demand is just weak, this business is going to be fine. But this whole global supply chain is going to be, you know, just all kinked up and there's going to be weird things going on. And this player in that supply chain is all, in all likelihood going to get through okay, but we became overly worried that it could not get through 2020, and so we don't care what the stock's priced at, we don't care how cheap it is. If it's not going to get through this time period, it's not cheap, right? And so while, like I said, we thought it would get through, it wasn't at a high enough kind of level of confidence for us. But the rest of our portfolio, we looked at it and said, we can get some terrible results and these companies are going to get through. We own both Home Depot and MasterCard. And last week, both of them issued significant levels of new debt at sub 4% cost of capital, with maturities going out 30 years. Oracle, which we don't own, but we used to own, just issued today $20 billion of new debt, and some of it going out 40 years, all of it sub 4%. The cost on that debt is the same as where Treasuries traded 18 months ago. And so these sorts of super strong businesses that not only have the kind of financial flexibility and the balance sheet, but can actually bring even more cash onto their balance sheet, either out of an abundance of caution or to buy back stock or to acquire other businesses going out of business, are all the sorts of features that we're looking for. So, you know, the process we went through was, you know, what is, not so much what's the worst case scenario, but what is the scenario that would damage our ability to hold these businesses to get through this period? Because here's the thing, on the other side of this crisis, whether that is kind of a rapid rebound that happens with growth returning in the fourth quarter and a kind of expansion in 2021, or whether that is, you know, after a couple of years of a, you know, multi-year recession, you see kind of a recovery. At that time, the competitive playing field in corporate America is going to have been swept clean of weaker players. I don't mean that in a flip way. Those are good people running, you know, fine businesses. But let's think about Starbucks. Starbucks is clearly in the crosshairs. Their stores are closed. What about Pete's? What about all the local coffee houses? They're not going to make it through. I shouldn't say that, Pete's. I don't have a view on Pete's, but local coffee houses are going to have a huge problem. Pete's may have a huge problem. In 2020, 2021, 2022, there will be far less competition for Starbucks. And that's the kind of reason why you want to be long, high quality companies, that this threat is an overwhelming threat to weaker companies. And by weaker companies, I don't mean bad companies, companies that just don't have as robust financial models, don't dominate their sectors, don't have strong balance sheets and access to capital. And so we believe very strongly that if you own these businesses through this time, on the other side of this, they're going to be in a really, really good position to take significant amounts of market share. And that's why you'd want to remain long these stocks, even if you worry that the economy might, you know, crumple more than whatever our base case is or whatever the case might be, is that there is a lot of opportunity on the other side of this, not for every business, but for businesses that can get there and remain very strong in that environment. And that's also true of every recession. Strong companies become even stronger coming to the other side, but it's far more dramatic at this time.
So is that basically how you decide what to own or not to own through 2020? It really comes down to survivability.
Yeah. So like I said, what we decide to own at all times is based on making sure they can survive even severe recessions. The conditions here are so abnormal that we had to look at that under a very different set of scenarios. We've owned MasterCard for approaching a decade now. Consumer spending was only down a couple percentage points during the financial crisis. MasterCard actually grew revenue in 2008, 2009. But Visa's out today, after the close yesterday, talking about quarter-to-date and month-to-date numbers. And things like cross-border fees, kind of the fees that Visa and MasterCard collect when you do a transaction that transfers cash between national banking systems and they earn higher fees from that. I mean, that's plummeting. Of course it is right now, right? In a way that it has not ever plummeted in the past and certainly not during past recessions. And then just overall transactions was Visa saying they were down in March, kind of similar levels of 2009 declines, right? So if we're all shut inside and we're not going out and spending, it's going to have very different sorts of effects. So in all environments, we want to own businesses that can get through even severe difficulties. And it's just that this set of severe difficulties is very abnormal. Remember, it's not just a recession, because at the same time there's severe difficulties, you also have other businesses seeing skyrocketing sales. I saw Campbell's Soup is like soup, cans of soup are up tremendously. We have zero interest in getting long a business that has a temporary benefit from all of this. And so, you know, owning things that are going to get through this, I think, is the most important thing. And if you have businesses in your business in your portfolio in which you are unsure of that, I mean, I wouldn't want to hold them through this period because the uncertainty level is so high.
One of the goals of the government stimulus is obviously to try to help tie over some businesses that may not get through on their own. So do you look at that at all, or do you consider that too speculative and too uncertain to kind of consider in the analysis?
So, you know, we describe ourselves as being macro aware, but not macro forecasters, in the sense that we never have here's our, you know, 3-year GDP outlook, and therefore we're long certain stocks. We tend to kind of assume a kind of a what we think of as a normalized return to kind of terminal growth or interest rates or inflation numbers, and so that doesn't tend to change all that much. And we do that recognizing that over, say, a 5 to 10 year time horizon, there's always going to be a recession. So it's not that we ever assume no recession. We assume that there will be recessions at kind of regular intervals, and we just can't pick exactly what year that's going to be. And when you see economic deterioration, you know, we certainly incorporate conditions and kind of the obvious ramifications of those conditions into our forward forecast for our businesses. Right now is really different because it's not an economic forecast to say, oh my gosh, you know, unemployment might go up. Like, it's happening right now. It's just, this isn't a forecast. This is real. And so, you know, we own Paychex, which is a payroll provider to small and medium sized businesses. They actually just reported recently in kind of far more optimistic tones than I think a lot of people would have expected. And one of the things they talked about is, you know, what's in the news right now, of course, is all the businesses that are closing, like restaurants, right? Restaurants are 6% of Paychex. Restaurants and hospitality is 6% of Paychex's customer base. But lots of small businesses are operating just fine, right? A lot of white collar sort of small businesses, CPAs, and lawyers, things like that. Life goes on, right? And so, you know, I think that in thinking about the stimulus package and the ramifications, if the stimulus package had not occurred, I think it'd be very, very difficult for anyone to say, oh yeah, we might recover at the end of the year and the economy's not going to go into a spiral. But it wasn't so much a forecast. Like, going into this, we recognized, look, unprecedented events trigger unprecedented reactions, right? And so early on, you heard people saying, well, you can't have a vaccine for 2 years. That's just how long it takes the FDA to clear things. And it's like, give me a break, right? If people are dying worldwide, all sorts of protocols are going to be shortcutted by authorities, right? So we don't have a forecast on when the vaccine comes out, but it's self-evident to anyone paying attention that these sorts of unprecedented conditions will create kind of unprecedented reactions, right? And the speeding up and counter reactions. And so we have never modeled out and said, well, we therefore think the contribution to GDP from the stimulus is X, you know, minus Y, figure out some other forecast. We don't do that. But we certainly are paying attention to what's going on. And I do think that it's important to recognize that the expanded unemployment benefits that were just passed will cover approximately like $50,000 a year in annualized salary for someone who's been laid off over a course of 4 months. And so a lot of people losing their jobs, that's how much they're making, right? I mean, some members of the GOP have been saying, hey, people could get paid more if they get laid off under this, right? And so setting aside whether that's a good or bad thing, this is a pretty, pretty healthy bridge. It's a 4-month bridge, not a 2-year bridge, right? And so I think there is, you know, very rational reasons to think that the stimulus package will provide this sort of bridge financing in a way to a lot of Americans, but it certainly doesn't fix everything, that's for sure.
You started the call with a statement that this time is different. I'd be curious if you could share your thoughts on what may be different after this is over.
Yeah, so I think that as soon as you have come to a determination,
that would require being reversed are unlikely to play out. So for instance, you know, I think everybody kind of looks around and says, well, remote work is going to be a lot more popular in the years ahead, which makes perfect sense to me, because not only is this event kind of giving everybody a crash course in making sure that their company can handle it, but this trend's already been in place for some time. you know, Google, you know, sent all these people home, their whole staff home to work remotely, you know, like 3 weeks ago now, I believe, 4 weeks ago. I mean, if everybody works remotely for another month and they come back, how many employers are going to say, like, why am I here every day again? Like, it worked fine for a couple of months. And that won't be true for every case. I think that some people have simplistically assumed, well, white collar jobs can all work remotely. But I talked to a scientist at Genentech recently. She's like, I'm a lab scientist. Like, I can't do stuff at home. There's like nothing I can do at home, right? And so there's plenty of kind of white collar jobs that do not work remotely. But I think that this trend was already in place. This event is going to accelerate that trend. And I would even go further to start thinking about, gosh, people are going to be socializing over Zoom. You know, my kid's school is holding parent meetings over Zoom. You know, my kid's going on like a trip for school and I have to go for an hour and hear about the trip plans, which has some critical information. But going forward, I'm like, why would I have to drive to the school and sit there for an hour when I should just be able to Zoom into that event from home while I have dinner and listen from there? So we do think there will be a lot of kind of additional acceleration of that trend in a lot of different ways. We've had some internal discussions around, might this trigger more people moving out of cities, right? So you've had an urbanization trend in place for a very long time. And I've generally thought, well, that would be a huge reversal moving people out of cities. And yet, one of the reasons people are able to move out of cities is you have higher costs in cities and you have remote work in place. Some can live, say, an hour and a half from a city and you don't have a commute time sort of issue. And so, you know, we've been watching and thinking and looking for signs that you may actually have a shift of home demand. It's not into kind of the rural areas, but into areas that are kind of further afield from the major metro areas, which would be a big trend reversal, but it may be a function of the trend acceleration of remote work. So I think that, you know, those are the things to look for. I also think that people have talked about, well, everything digital will accelerate. I saw an interesting, just a little one-off thing that podcast downloads have declined by 10% over the last 30 days with unique users down 20%. And podcasts are very much listened to during commute time, right? So remote work way it actually really hurt kind of a what was actually a very quickly growing trend in a digital product. So, you know, I think those are the sorts of things that we're looking at. The other big one is, I think, healthcare. Maybe 3 or 4 years now, we've been writing about how we've been typically avoiding most healthcare stocks other than those businesses, which we think both reduce the cost of healthcare while improving patient outcomes. Some companies do achieve both those things, but historically, if you could improve patient outcomes, the cost almost didn't matter. And that was an investable theme or kind of a positive ROI experience for a healthcare company. And, you know, I find it almost implausible we don't get Medicare for everybody who wants it, as Buttigieg labeled it, in the years ahead. You know, I think that this sort of event is going to trigger many Americans across the political spectrum to believe that there needs to be kind of a broader healthcare safety net, especially because this event makes very clear that the health conditions of your neighbor very much applies to you as well, and that each of us don't live kind of uniquely. None of that speaks at all to my personal views on healthcare, which is not part of kind of how we think about what's going to happen. It's just a function of what we think will happen.
And Sean, you also had an interesting thought with some of the news coming out that Instacart or Whole Foods employees are discussing strikes, whether the winners from a surging demand perspective right now will emerge from the crisis stronger or weaker, and that investors should pay attention to that. Could you just elaborate a little bit on that nuance? Because I think a lot of folks are focused purely on the demand aspect in terms of determining the winners here.
Yeah, so I think we're used to, as investors, generally believing that a lot of demand is a good thing. The more the demand, the better. And the faster it grows, the better, right? I mean, when a business that most of us own starts growing faster and faster, we're like, well, this is all to the good. But if you have a demand surge that is so large that you fail your customers or fail your staff or fail any of your stakeholders, it could actually damage the business in the medium term, not even the long term, but relatively quickly. Amazon is one example because they're such a clear beneficiary of all of this, right? I mean, like, it's amazing to think. I tried to order something from them. It was an Ethernet switch, you know, because I'm working from home now and we had it all set up, but I wanted to add one little thing. And it was a month out for the delivery, right? And across all vendors, because it was not an essential item. And so they were rightly prioritizing their essential items. And so because of that, I said, well, I can buy it someplace else. And guess what? Best Buy offers like 2-day free delivery and they don't have an essential item prioritization issue. And one thing I wonder about Amazon is whether or not over the next month, people like myself who have historically ordered, say, 95% of all online orders via Amazon might be reminded that, like, oh yeah, pretty much everybody offers free fast delivery these days. And you know, there's lots of ways to find products and it's all pretty quick. When the PayPal checkout now allows you to pay with preloaded payment and delivery instructions, not even having to set up accounts at other stores. And so this is sort of example that the huge amount of demand, you know, it's like the old Yogi Berra quote, is too crowded, so nobody goes there anymore sort of thing, right? And so if Amazon might be too crowded, causing people like myself who are long-term dedicated customers to explore and recognize, oh, there's these other offerings out there that work well. We don't own Amazon. We're not short Amazon, not necessarily negative on Amazon. It's just a kind of element of this that feels unexpected. And then certainly if any business fails their employees during this, they could have much larger problems on their hand than that might be appreciated when you just look at the demand side of things.
Could you talk a little bit about your day-to-day and the day-to-day of your team and whether the process has changed at all as a result of working remotely?
In our case, it wasn't much of a change. So 3 years ago, we implemented kind of a really strong remote work platform. We have 15 people on staff and 5 of them are full-time remote, 2 here in the Bay Area, but still full-time remote, and then 3 in other cities. So all of us, that was very kind of fluid for us. It's been a total non-issue. I actually think that it's a really good thing for research organizations to have staff in different parts of the country with different life experiences and kind of demographic environments. So from our perspective, having our research team spread out geographically and working remotely for a number of years now, I think it's been a big benefit. I was worried initially about downsides around culture and connecting. But when the whole organization commits to something, as opposed to like you have one full-time remote employee, your culture adapts to it and it's been a non-issue. So for us, that has not been a big change. I think one thing that we've been wrestling with is that we're focused investors, right? We invest in kind of 20, 25 companies. And I believe that up until, say, around the year 2000, a lot of investment work, research work, was about trying to acquire information, hopefully information that people didn't have or hadn't bothered to look for yet. And I think that over the last 20 years, with access information becoming ubiquitous, it's become much more about filtering, and much more about understanding what do you not pay attention to, and filtering out stuff better than your competition so that you remain looking at what is most important, at least to your process and strategy. And so that's kind of an approach we've used for a long time now. But over the last month, we've kind of had this struggle with saying, we need to focus on our companies, but also we need to widen our filters dramatically because we know there is a lot of unexpected information coming in, a lot of information about things like epidemiology that, you know, no one on staff here is an expert on that. And so we've recognized that we needed to kind of widen our filters, which creates this kind of fire hose of information, which is a struggle for a firm that is kind of dedicated to the idea of being focused in information that we acquire. And yet that's an important thing, is to kind of recognize that if you can't be overly focused and miss important stuff. So, you know, we've just had multiple discussions of trying to figure out what is the right kind of aperture, I guess you'd say, of that filter and how wide and when should you be focused in, and recognizing under what sorts of scenarios should we be very focused in the information we're processing, and in what areas do we need to be kind of more wide open and absorbing information. Because you could really go astray if you got really caught up in paying attention to every daily tick on new case counts and death counts and recognize that at the end of the day, that's not how you're going to generate alpha, right? You're going to generate alpha from understanding your businesses better. But understanding your businesses means understanding the environment in which they're operating. And that's where our apertures have had to kind of widen up on the filters.
I'm not sure to what extent you can comment on specific companies, but a questioner is asking for your thoughts on Schwab in this low interest rate environment.
Yeah, so, you know, last year, Schwab executed what, in our opinion, is kind of one of the more masterful competitive moves in any industry, and certainly in their industry in a long time, where they, you know, subsequently you learned that they had been negotiating to buy TD Ameritrade, and these businesses are very much scale businesses. So when TD bought Scottrade, if I remember the numbers correctly, they were able to eliminate 70% of Scottrade's cost structure because they overlap with their own. And so something similar should happen with Schwab, but they were negotiating with TD. They couldn't come to a deal. And so Schwab just said, fine, look, commissions are gone. They only were generating, I believe, about 7% of their revenue from commissions. TD and Fidelity and everyone else who mattered was much, much higher levels. And so Schwab basically removed that revenue stream, kind of hurting themselves in the short term, but permanently damaging the business models of their competition, and then was able to shortly thereafter there acquire TD. And we think, you know, they've changed the business models in the industry in a way that makes them far, far stronger than their competition. It's a very important question to say yes, but now they're not getting commissions, but they're earning net interest margin on the cash in their client accounts that's being swept into their bank. And so if interest rates are low, or kind of more precisely, that interest margins are compressed over the long term, they're not going to earn as much money. So I think there's two ways to answer that. One is that, you know, if net interest margins return to kind of whatever you believe kind of normal levels are in past years, there's so it's incredible upside to Schwab's stock. If net interest margins stay compressed, but certainly not like zero or something, but they stay at very compressed levels, you know, we think the stock is still undervalued. And then the last thing I would just say is that Schwab, one of the things that we've liked about them is that they have stayed true to their core value proposition while changing the monetization model over time. So, you know, commissions used to be basically 100% of their revenue, right? And then they became, you know, offered fees on asset management. They created OneSource and got fees on asset managers' products and all those sorts of things. And then they created net interest margin. One thing you don't do is you don't actually pay for custody. But in Europe and in some institutional relationships, people just pay for custody. Right? So 10 basis points just for having assets with them. So, you know, there's lots of things they could do around financial planning fees, subscription fees, you know, custody fees, that we think that if over the next couple of years, they come to believe that net interest margin is just going to be a kind of non-viable source of revenue and profit or not enough, that they can generate other ways to monetize the asset base. So pre the acquisition, they were approaching $4 trillion in assets under administration. And one of the things we've looked at is just kind of what is their total revenue as a basis points on those assets, forgetting about how they generate it. And we're comfortable with that level. And we think one way or another, they're able to charge that over time. We do think the interest margins come back over time, but if they were to not do that, you know, Schwab has other levers they could pull to monetize those assets.
And Sean, just one other company-specific question, if we could, before we wrap it up. There's a question around the staying power of a booking in this environment.
Yeah, so that is our position that is most directly in the crosshairs, right? I mean, travel in particular and hospitality, like it's this devastation in that industry. So, you know, booking is getting a commission effectively for generating demand on behalf of primarily independent hotels. They are the largest source of delivering customers to the hotel industry. And so the way we think about it is that luckily they have a very flexible cost structure. First of all, they generate about 40%. So, you know, pre-crisis at 40% EBITDA margins, and 60% of their expenses are demand generation. So primarily Google ads, but basically, you know, sales and marketing expenses they incur to generate reservations for their hotel partners. And so if there is no demand, those costs fall very, very quickly, right? So CPCs are the cost you have to pay to run an ad for a hotel. Skift, which is one of the industry leaders, was showing it down like 74% already, right? It's just there's no one's advertising anymore for that. And so there's no demand. We believe very strongly that booking will not go chase demand that's not there and overpay. They're extremely ROI focused on their marketing spend. So that portion of it, as long as there's no demand, the costs are going to come down dramatically. They also have, I believe it's $6 billion of cash on their balance sheet, plus some untapped revolver. You know, we just think that, you know, even under unbelievable compression of hotel occupancy that extends for a long period of time, that they get through this period. And on the other side, what you have is you have hotels struggling with low occupancy, desperately in need of guests to come and stay there. And Booking is going to be the player to bring those guests to them on a commission basis, right? Where they're only paying if they deliver to somebody. So we think that the importance of Booking to their hotel partners on the other side of this will be far more intense than it has been in recent years, even to the extent of kind of the global branded businesses, the hotels like the Hiltons or, you know, Hyatts of the world, which are much less dependent on online travel agents because they have their own kind of loyalty lists and things like that. They're still going to have lower occupancy. And if you have excess occupancy, it tends to make sense to go pay somebody to deliver it to you, which guests fill that occupancy. So, you know, our thesis on the stock is basically that they will get through it. Wall Street Journal and Information have been reporting on Airbnb's struggles. They're very likely to get through it, but they are simply not in the same sort of cost structure, beneficial position that that Booking is. And so it's an example of the competitive playing field. You know, Airbnb has been a real kind of threat to Booking in a lot of ways, and the competitive playing field here after this. So it's, you know, next year and the years beyond that, Airbnb, we think, will be diminished as a competitive threat. And they're not going to go away. I'm a customer. I love it. I have a good friend who's a senior executive there. You know, they're going to get through all of this, and I wish them no ill will. But from a relative competitive standpoint, Booking will be in a better position on the other side of this.
And Sean, do you have any parting thoughts as we all look to what looks to be an uncertain set of months ahead?
You know, I think at the end of the day, like, this is why equity returns are so much higher than safer, lesser, more certain investments, right? So why is the equity risk premium there? Why can you earn, you know, historically 9% a year, you know, well in excess of kind of more guaranteed sorts of returns? It's because of uncertainty, right? And we're seeing kind of this dramatic example of how, you know, things, true uncertainty is not, we don't know when the next recession is going to come. True uncertainty is things we've never dealt with before might happen, right? And that level of uncertainty, you know, I think that be careful of recognizing that uncertainty is not always bad. Earlier on in this crisis, like a month ago, 6 weeks ago, we were blogging about the uncertainty around the path of the virus. And some people were saying, well, you guys seem really optimistic. You're saying how uncertain it is. And we were saying, well, but uncertainty is the definition of risk. If I tell you I'm uncertain where the market's going to go next year, that doesn't mean I think it's going to go up, right? But uncertainty means you don't know which direction it's going to go and what exactly is going to happen. And so I think just recognizing that the level of uncertainty is at kind of record highs right now. And yet that doesn't mean that it's just there's going to be more bad stuff than you expect. There could also be better than expected outcomes. It's a sign of kind of how pessimistic, especially as just a week ago, people were, that it was almost blasphemy to suggest that some things might be better than we currently expect. And, you know, so I think that it's just very important to keep an open mind about what's going on, recognize that you don't know what's going on, that the best epidemiologist cannot tell us, you know, how bad this is going to get. And the best economists do not know what happens when you shut the global economy. It's just hasn't been tried before. So we can all make informed speculations about that. And we can think about, you know, how bad could it end up and can our companies get through this? And then we need to keep our eyes open and keep paying attention to new data as it comes in and recognize that some of the things that I said on this call may prove to be wrong in a month. I might have strong evidence that things I believed a week or a month ago are not true. And we as investors need to accept that new information and then act on whatever we know at that time.
Terrific. Well, Sean, this has been very helpful. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us and share your perspective with our members. We truly appreciate it.
John, thanks for having me and thanks for putting these on. I've been listening to some of the other investors you've had on and it's been a very helpful process. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much. And thanks everyone for listening. Goodbye for now.